The title of my discussion this afternoon is Christianity and Humanism, Friends or Foes? You've undoubtedly all seen the beginning of Mystery, where the young lady, obviously attractive, but alone, comes home to her apartment, opens the door, comes in, perhaps walks into the kitchen, only to hear a noise in the apartment somewhere. She's startled. We're startled. The music is going to help us in the background be startled, if nothing else. And she cries out, "Who is it?" Or perhaps you are a war buff fan. You like to watch the movies celebrating maiming and killing and all these other wonderful human abilities. And here's the soldier who's out on point. He's watching the night, and he hears a sound out in the brush. And he cries out, "Who goes there?" Source of unexpected alarm. We need to identify it to know whether we should be alert, to respond defensively to it, or whether we can relax. You perhaps have seen also a portrayal of the medieval castle where the watcher on the wall at night cannot tell who it is that's riding up, and he cries out, "Who goes there, friend or foe?" Now, that always was curious to me, just as an aside, because if it was a foe, you would think they would lie anyway, just so they could gain access and then do their fiendish deed inside. But nevertheless, that's the way it's portrayed to us. It was a different society, I guess. Friend or foe, and people were expected to identify themselves clearly. It'd be easy to become confused these days as to how humanism and Christianity relate to one another. I feel like calling out to... Friend or foe? Who's coming? Who is that out there? What do you mean by humanism? What are we talking about? If you look at the history textbooks, you'll sometimes read of such individuals as Erasmus, who are called Christian humanists. Christians, like myself, often teach and promote the humanities in the curriculum of college, university. In fact, some Christians have become world-famous humanitarians. And yet, on the other hand, secular humanism is portrayed in a wide range of literature, both from a Christian and from a secular standpoint, as being the arch-enemy of Christianity, certainly the arch-enemy of biblical and historic Christianity. And so, how is it today? Friend or foe? How is humanism to be looked upon? Are Christianity and humanism friends? They basically accomplishing the same thing in different ways, or are they perhaps accomplishing different things, but the different things are harmonious with one another? Or are they really, in method as well as in goal, arch enemies? Obviously, just like the person who was startled in the dark, we're going to need to identify what we're dealing with. And so I'm going to begin today by asking, what is humanism? First, what it's not. Humanism is not humanitarianism. We're not talking about humanitarianism, although I have seen formal debates with people who at least claim to be educated confuse the two. Humanism is not humanitarianism. Humanitarianism is the promotion of human welfare and social reform. Now, the Christian scriptures have a lot to say in support of just those interests, human welfare and social reform. Think of the first and great commandment as Jesus gave it, to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And the second, he said, is like unto it, to love your neighbor as yourself. And on those two commandments, said Jesus, everything in the Old Testament rests. Everything in the Law and the Prophets hangs on that. Or James, the first chapter, says that pure religion before our God, pure religion, if you really want to get down to where the rubber hits the road, you want to see what the bottom line of being a Christian is, pure religion before our God is to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction. And so Christians are, if they are good Christians, faithful Christians, they are in principle humanitarian. They ought to be. I can add here, along with humanitarian, we're not talking about being humane either, another thing that's confused with humanism. To be humane is to act with compassion and sympathy with people, for people, because of their human nature, because they are human beings, we are compassionate toward them. Christians should be humane, they should be humanitarian. All right, so on the one hand, humanism is not to be confused with humanitarianism or being humane. On the other hand, humanism should not be confused with the humanities. We're not talking about support of or opposition to the humanities, for if we were, we'd have to say that scientists, natural scientists, are not humanists. They cannot be, because they don't promote the humanities. They promote natural science, but that would be a rather silly way of putting it. The humanities are those branches of learning which are predominantly cultural in character rather than physical or sociological or what have you. Often the humanities have been called the liberal arts, the arts which liberate, that are either the promotion of or the practice of freedom in a culture. And they include such fields as history, philosophy, literature, speech, art, music, and the like. Now, in many of these fields, or at many times and places, I hope you'll note that it has been Christians who have led the way. Let me give you just some real quick passing illustrations. Over the last 1,000 years, at least up to the 20th century, the theory and development of speech communication has been in the hands of Christian pastors and theologians. Obviously, because of their interest in preaching the scriptures, they've had an interest in preaching, which is a form of communication. And so it's been a natural thing. But the liberal arts, in that respect, have been promoted by Christianity, and Christianity has led the way. Which isn't to say that what's been said by Christians in that area have always been right, but nevertheless, it certainly has been what's promoted and stimulated discussion. Or consider the zenith of Western musical composition, Bach, not Mick Jagger. Bach, who was a very dedicated Christian, who signed all of his compositions to the glory of the Most High God. Or you can hardly think of men of literary stature without mentioning the names of Milton or T.S. Eliot. And of course, in history, any student of history is going to have to remember the towering reputation of Augustine. And so we could go on and on. Christians are not in any sense opposed to the humanities. In fact, as I've said, some of the leading teachers in the humanities have been Christians. All right, so who goes there? Who's out there? Well, not the humanitarians and the humanities. I mean, we're all part of that. So what is it that humanism is that's out there? Well, some more distinctions. And in real sense, if you catch on to these distinctions, you can get to the heart of what I want to tell you today. It's just because of the ambiguities or the equivocations in the discussions of so many people that when Christians are said to oppose humanism, people can carry off such a persuasive argument against Christianity, saying, how could anybody be against the liberal arts, or being against being compassionate, or against social reform? Well, that's not humanism. Well, so we have to draw one more distinction. There is a historic sense for humanism, or if you will, humanism used as a historical movement. As a phase of historical development, humanism was a philosophical and literary movement which originated in Italy in the second half of the 14th century, then diffusing into other European countries, and indeed constituting the major characteristic of the Renaissance, the rebirth of Western culture. You see, the humanists, as they called themselves and were called, hoped that education specifically in classical letters, could rekindle a spirit which man had possessed in the golden ages of Greece and Rome. Humanism thus brought a return to antiquity attitude or motif with it. To be a humanist meant to go back to the classics. It stressed man's freedom and man's place in nature and man's place in history. Man is the epitome of nature. Man is the determiner of history. And so rebirth was sought in the study of the humanities, disciplines which were believed to create cultured men with humane interest. Now we begin to see the connection between these words. The humanist, who wanted to go back to ancient Greece in particular, but Rome as well, who wanted to return to the classics, these humanists thought that we could be reborn, culture could be reborn, if we would study the humanities, the liberal arts. Because the liberal arts developed our human nature in such a way that we became humanitarian, humane people, educated and cultural. Niccolo Abignano's article, Humanism, in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, Volume 4, states this about Renaissance humanism as a historical movement now, and I quote, "For all its antipathy toward asceticism and theology, humanism did not have an anti-religious or anti-Christian character." That's page 71 of volume 4. It says, it's true the humanists didn't want to get into the niceties of theological reflection. They didn't want to get into the subtle points of theology. They let that go. It's also true that they believed that man should affirm his place in the natural order, that they had a worldly interest. They believed in refined culture. They did not have what we might today call a fundamentalist attitude toward culture, where man withdraws from anything that might appear to be pleasurable, denying, say, the pleasures of the body, eating or sex or sleep, whatever it may be. The ascetics said, of course, we must punish our bodies. Pleasure and comfort are wrong because we are sinners and we should always be brought to our knees and humbled before God. The humanists didn't believe that sort of thing. They were refined people in the sense that people interested in culture might say. And so Abignano, I think, is right that although they had an antipathy toward asceticism, and they certainly were not interested in theology, humanism did not have an anti-religious character. It was not intended to be an attack, an all-out assault upon the Christian faith or upon religious interest. The Renaissance humanist held on to priorities, held on to methods of thought which were not Christian, I believe. But for most of them, it was still not their intention to wage a frontal attack on religion. Now, let me give you an analogy so you are clear. Hopefully, you'll be at least a little clearer as to what I'm saying. If a doctor treats a patient in a particular way, and in so doing, only exacerbates the condition of the patient because he's using the wrong method, that isn't to say that the doctor is malicious. He may simply be ignorant. He may not be a good practitioner of his science. It may be that all of medical science put together didn't realize that this isn't the way to handle this particular kind of problem. And so the Renaissance humanist, I'm saying, really exacerbated an anti-religious spirit, which I'm going to talk about in just a moment. But I think it's true. It can be said that they were not malicious. They did not really think they were anti-religious people. Yes, there are some. They are the exceptions to the rule. There were some who would say they didn't want anything to do with religion, that God should be banished from the universe. But they really are the more dramatic, the extreme fringe. The humanists felt that they were Christians, but they were developing human interest, and that theology was for somebody else. And so, as I say, they held on to priorities, and they held on to a method of thought which was not Christian, but for them it was not their intention to wage a frontal attack on religion. And that's why you can have men like Desiderius Erasmus, whose dates are 1466 to 1536, men like Erasmus who stressed ancient learning and man's freedom, stressed man's potential, how history had a bright future because of the human potential. And these men were called Christian humanists. Nevertheless, among those Renaissance humanists who wished to be considered friends of the Christian religion, at least considered friends, there was a spirit at work which strained very hard against traditional Christian theological tenets. And I think a fine example is found in Pico della Mirandola's famous essay, Oration on the Dignity of Man. Mirandola's dates are 1463 to 1494. If you want to put this into perspective, you must remember, every student of Western culture must remember 1517. Okay, that's the date that Luther nails the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg church door. And we celebrate that at the end of this month on what the secular world calls Halloween and the Protestant reformers called Reformation Day. We celebrate what Luther did. Now, this is 1517. Mirandola died in 1494. All right, so basically 20, 25 years difference between them. Now, he wrote a famous essay, and he considered himself a Christian apologist, entitled Oration on the Dignity of Man. I want you to consider this quotation from it. This is God speaking to Adam. Of course, it's not God speaking to Adam. It's Mirandola putting words into the mouth of God, speaking to Adam, okay? And he says, I have given you, Adam, neither a predetermined place, nor a particular aspect, nor any special prerogatives, in order that you may take and possess these through your own decision and choice. The limitations on the nature of other creatures are contained within my prescribed laws. You shall determine your own nature without constraint from any barrier by means of the freedom to whose power I have entrusted you. I have placed you at the center of the world so that from that point you might see better what is in the world. I have made you neither heavenly nor earthly, neither mortal nor immortal, so that like a free and sovereign artificer, you might mold and fashion yourself into that form you yourself have chosen. Now, I don't know how many this afternoon might be students of philosophy or 20th century thought, especially of the writings of Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist, but had I not known the introduction to this particular quotation, I would have easily said that's Sartre speaking. Sartre says, man is the one who strives to be his own God. Man determines his own nature. He first exists, says Sartre, then chooses his essence. Okay? The predominant, the most important thing about man is that he is a brute fact. He exists. And after that, he goes about deciding for himself and bearing the full brunt of the responsibility, deciding for himself what kind of man he will be, what moral code he shall follow. Well, Mirandola was saying the same thing back at the end of the 1400s. But he was saying it in the name of a Christian theologian, interestingly enough, a Christian humanist. All right, so we need to move on from Renaissance humanism as a historical movement to what I will now call the humanist spirit, the humanist attitude. In the historical movement of what we've just called Renaissance humanism, which surely represented many gains in scholarship, many advances in culture. I don't want to take anything away that the humanists have deserved. But nevertheless, in that movement, there was to be found, unfortunately, the seed of the humanist attitude. And it's this attitude which has been nourished and developed within Western culture, now being harvested in the 20th century as the self-conscious philosophy of humanism. All right. So that name, humanism, start drawing some distinctions. I'm going to be talking today not about the movement of humanism, nor about humanitarianism and the humanities. I'm going to talk about a self-conscious philosophy, a self-conscious approach to human difficulties, self-conscious approach to truth in the world called humanism. What is the humanist spirit? What is that attitude already at work back in Renaissance humanism, but now followed for its own sake in the 20th century? In a word, it's the attitude of autonomy, autonomy from God. Autonomy is, in the English language, one example of how words retain their etymological sense. That isn't often the case, but here it's beautifully represented because autonomy comes from the Greek word autos and nomos. Autos means self, nomos, law. The autonomous man is a law to himself. That law to himself, of course, is easy to see in, like, ethics, where a person decides on his own what the standards of right and wrong will be. But autonomy also comes to play in epistemology, the theory of knowledge, where man determines for himself what the standards of truth will be, determines for himself what he will bow to and what he will believe. And so you have the idea of the self-sufficient, scholarly, rational, independent, autonomous man. That's the humanist spirit. I quoted from Abignano's article a few moments ago. Let me continue. He says, humanism is also any philosophy which recognizes the value or dignity of man and makes him the measure of all things. Humanism looks at man, says, there's something with value. There's something that's dignified, and that will be taken as the standard. That will be the benchmark for determining right and wrong, true and false. He will be the measure, or she will be the measure, of all things. It is significant here that the Protestant Reformation, led by the brave efforts and theological perception of Martin Luther, stood squarely against the humanist spirit, which was found in the historical movement called humanism. Okay? So here's this movement called humanism, and I'm saying there's the seed in there, there's the heart of the movement, the humanist spirit. And that humanist spirit was just squarely contradicted by Martin Luther, by others as well. But Luther's a good illustration because his finest theological treatise was not the 95 Theses, although historically they're more important, I suppose. But his finest theological treatise was written in debate with Erasmus, the Christian humanist. And the title of Luther's treatise pointed to the heart of their dispute. And you must remember that Luther said, as this debate went back and forth, Luther said that he was glad for Erasmus's opposition because he said, this brings us to the heart of the Reformation. Now, I'm speaking anachronistically as though Luther used the word Reformation. My point is, Luther said, this is what we want to see corrected. This is at the very heart of the matter. And the title of the treatise, On the Bondage of the Will. On the Bondage of the Will. Erasmus, you see, was teaching human freedom, that man is not bound by sin, does not have a darkened mind, that his scholarship and that his ethic and the development of culture are quite possible within the natural talents and abilities of man, that man is good, basically. And Luther said, oh no, Erasmus, you've got it wrong. Man is not free. Man is not good. He's in bondage to sin, and he cannot break that bondage. Yes, he was originally good. He was noble. He was made in the very image of God. And it's only that which accounts for the achievements of men. But the fact remains that even with their best achievements, men are slaves of sin. And so Luther emphasized the idea that a man with a great deal of ability only uses that ability in a destructive way because he's a sinner. That, if you will, it's like having, I'm using a modern illustration, Luther didn't speak of buzzsaws, but if you have a buzzsaw that is very sharp, a very good blade, and a very strong motor, the fact of the matter is that you can set the buzzsaw at any angle on the wood. And a buzzsaw set at the wrong angle, if it's a good buzzsaw, it's just going to do a whole lot of damage. A bad buzzsaw will do a little bit of damage. But whether it's a good or a bad buzzsaw, it's not going to do any good until its direction is correct. And because man's direction is against his creator, he's in rebellion against the source of his life, because he is trying to create standards of goodness for himself and therefore saying God is irrelevant, he's in bondage to sin. And what will always come of human ability is selfishness and the destruction of genuine human pursuits. And so Luther said, we dare not make such a person the measure of all things. We do not want to take somebody who's enslaved to sin and say, now there's the measure, there's the standard for right or wrong. See, the ancient Greek philosopher, the sophist, those of you who are studying speech will appreciate the sophist. The philosophers were against the sophist, and so you have to remember we have a little bit of historical school spirit to defend here. Well, the good guys, the philosophers, opposed the sophists like Protagoras, who said, now look, man is the measure of all things, and so the best thing you can do is teach people to persuade others of their own point of view. Help people to get along in life. That's all that counts. Because there isn't any truth, man will be the measure of all things. Okay, so Renaissance humanism has in it the spirit of autonomy, a self-law. Man is good. Man has great potential. Man, in fact, if you want the title of another Renaissance humanist work, Thomas More's Utopia. Man will create a utopia out of his own intellectual and moral abilities. Luther said, forget it. Well, that's not a quote, but that was certainly what the thrust of On the Bondage of the Will could be summarized as being. Luther said, no man is in bondage. Let me give you three illustrations of this philosophy of humanism now as it's been harvested in the 20th century. Three dictionaries of philosophy can be looked at. They very nicely put their finger on it. The reason I go to these three, by the way, is because I wouldn't want you to think that this is just some kind of person who got up on the wrong side of the bed having a, he has to find some opponent. You know, there are people like that in this world. We call them of contrary spirit. They've always got to be against something. And sadly, there are some Christians who act like that too. You know, just like they're always grumping at something. They never enjoy the freedom of being a Christian and, you know, the goodness of what God has given them and that sort of thing. They always have to find enemies, it seems like. Well, there are enough real ones out there. And what I want to point out is that I'm not fabricating this philosophy of humanism as an enemy of Christianity. If I were, you would see that, you know, the, well, none of the three that I'm going to quote here are Christians in the first place, but those who are humanists themselves would be counted on, it seems to me, to put their best foot forward. And putting their best foot forward, here's what we find. Runes, Dictionary of Philosophy, and I quote, "Humanism is any view in which the welfare and happiness of mankind in this life is primary." What's of the highest value? Man's welfare in this life. You see, if somebody said man's highest good is his welfare, as a Christian I could say, well, that's okay. And where is man's welfare? In his Creator. Being reconciled to God through Jesus Christ will bring him the greatest of welfares, and so that's fine. I can buy that. But the humanist says, no, 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 we don't care about apple pie in the sky by and by. We want it right now, and a la mode. We want human welfare in this life. That's all that counts. And I go on with the quote, "and relies on the methods of reason, science, and democracy for the solution of human problems." That is very helpful. You see, there are plenty of human problems. Christians and humanists would both say that. How do we solve them? What method do we use? Well, reason, meaning here not reason that's subordinate to the Word of God, but human reason, self-sufficient reason. Reason, science, and in the social sphere, democracy will bring about a solution to all human problems. Let me give you another illustration here. Anthony Flew's Dictionary of Philosophy. And I quote, "In this century, the label humanism has been appropriated by those who reject all religious beliefs, insisting that we should be exclusively concerned with human welfare in this allegedly the only world." Who is a humanist? Who has the attitude of humanism? What is the self-conscious philosophy of humanism? The rejection of supernatural beliefs and supernatural interests, the rejection of religious intrusion into the autonomy of man's thinking and ethic, putting all those things aside and insisting we should concern ourselves exclusively with human welfare in this world alone. And then one more. Peter Angelis' recent Dictionary of Philosophy defines philosophical humanism in this way, and I quote, "a philosophy that A, regards the rational individual as the highest value." Philosophers have a terrific way of being short-sighted. I mean, all the while sounding sophisticated and educated. I noticed this. I was a Christian when I did my PhD work in epistemology at SC, and I respect the intellect and the training of my professors, but, you know, those who were the most antagonistic to religion in general and Christianity in particular also seemed to me to make the greatest faith commitments of all. They would say this sort of thing: a philosophy that regards the rational individual as the highest value. Well, for crying out loud, I mean, you don't have to be a Christian to see if that's the highest value, then human history is pretty much down the garbage bin, isn't it? That's the best you can do? That's the highest value? Now look at the human achievement, right? Yes, we've gotten to the moon, but we've also, you know, found a way of destroying 50,000 people at the drop of one bomb. Isn't that terrific? What a human achievement. The rational individual who uses his abilities for what? Getting himself ahead. I mean, how many scientific achievements do you see today that are genuinely, selflessly being used for the advancement of the human race? They're not. They're being used to advance, well, take genetic engineering, which is a terrific potential for taking care of human problems, right? The reason there are so many corporations that are fighting like cats and dogs over the advances in genetic engineering is because they recognize that whoever gets to the goal line first is going to make a whole lot of people happy, right? No, going to make me happy because I'm going to get the royalties and I'm going to become very wealthy. This is the rational individual. This is the man who Erasmus thought had a free will, who was not, as Luther, of course, the old-fashioned theologian said, in bondage to sin and selfish pursuits. Well, now I'm preaching. Let me go back. A philosophy that regards the rational individual as the highest value. B, considers the individual to be the ultimate source of value. Not only is the individual, as a rational being, the value which is highest in this world, but if you're going to find any value, you've got to depend upon the rational individual. Now, there's an interesting combination of things, isn't there? And again, I depart from my text, but notice, the rational individual is the highest value, and where do we find our values? We go to the rational individual to find our values. He's the source of our values, which is to say that if you let human beings be the source of ethical standards, you know what they'll finally come up with? Themselves. Well, they'll end up with a mess. That's the consequences. But isn't it amazing that when you turn over the authority to make moral decisions to an individual, he makes the standard himself? I can't help but think here of Hegel, of course, who had this grand philosophy of history, which, if I'm not careful, I'll take the rest of your lunch hour talking about. Hegel was a dialectician of history. He believed that history moved inexorably in a dialectical fashion. There was a thesis, there would be a type of culture in existence that would create by rebellion its own antithesis, that which was over against it, and then history would be moved along because at a higher level there would be a resolution or a synthesis of the thesis and the antithesis. But that synthesis would then become a way of life that created its own rebellious antithesis, and it would be resolved at a higher level. And so this, you see, is what causes history to go ahead. Thesis, antithesis, resolution. Resolution creating another antithesis, resolution, and on and on and on. And so somebody says, well, where does it all end? Hegel had an answer. Hegel said the whole dialect of history ended in the Prussian state in which Hegel was living. These people come up with grand designs philosophically, and they always end up putting, they're always king of the mountain when we get done. You know, talk about selfishness. It's, you know, the Bible puts it in more theological language, but philosophically I can tell you the nature of sin is demonstrated in the philosophers continually. If you let man be the source of value, he will turn around and make himself the standard. Since I'm the source of values, I am going to be the value. I will make myself king of the mountain. So this is humanism, we're being told. And then C, continue the quote, is dedicated to fostering the individual's creative and moral development in a meaningful and rational way without reference to concepts of the supernatural. Without reference to any supernatural. The only meaningful and rational way to develop human potential is to do away with anything that involves supernatural intrusion into our lives and thinking. So what is humanism? Who goes there? Is this friend or foe out here, this humanism we're talking about? Well, since I haven't stated my conclusion yet, nobody can see exactly where I'm going to end up. I'll continue for a minute. I brought with me a couple of interesting illustrations here of what humanism is. This is a document that was published by the American Humanist Association, which was founded in the 1940s, and it's a promotional piece. It's a pamphlet that I have Xeroxed in which they are pushing humanism. And as you can see, it says, "What is humanism?" So again, I'm not making this up. They speak for themselves. Humanism is the belief that man shapes his own destiny. It is a constructive philosophy, a non-theistic religion, a way of life. There's no question about it. Humanism is a religion, not a supernatural one. It's a naturalistic religion. Religion because it has an ultimate commitment, because it specifies man's place in the universe and how man should live. It talks about the origin of man and his destiny. It does all the things that traditional religions do, but it does it without any appeal to a supernatural deity. Humanism is the belief that man shapes his own destiny. It is a constructive philosophy, a non-theistic religion, a way of life. The humanist relies upon himself and his fellow man rather than upon any supernatural power. Close your eyes to history, you know, when you say that sort of thing. Relies upon himself and on his fellow man. He endeavors to become more tolerant and compassionate. And now we quote Julian Huxley. I use the word humanist to mean someone who believes that man is just as much a natural phenomenon as an animal or plant. That his body, mind, and soul, mind and soul, natural ingredients, part of evolution, right? First you have some kind of organism that doesn't have a mind, and then it somehow develops a mind. And then, of course, Christians are ridiculed for believing in creation out of nothing. Well, here we have evolution out of nothing. Non-mind becomes mind. But I depart from the text. I use the word humanist to mean someone who believes that man is just as much a natural phenomenon as an animal or plant, that his body, mind, and soul were not supernaturally created, but are products of evolution, and that he is not under the control or guidance of any supernatural being or beings, but has to rely on himself and his own powers. Eric Fromm, humanist ethics is based on the principle that only man himself can determine the criterion for virtue and sin, and not an authority transcending him. A.E. Hayden, the humanist has a feeling of perfect at-homeness in the universe. He is conscious of himself as an earth child. There is a mystic glow in this sense of belonging. That sounds like naturalism, doesn't it? A mystic glow in the sense of belonging here. Memories of his long ancestry still ring in muscle and nerve, in brain and germ cell. Rooted in millions of years of planetary history, he has a secure feeling of being at home and a consciousness of pride and dignity as a bearer of the heritage of the ages and a growing creative center of cosmic life. There is a thrill in the thought that man must be the creator and master of his own destiny. What is humanism? Who goes there? I'll tell you now in a word. Humanism is a religious philosophy that is opposed to everything that Christianity stands for. If you want to go back to the Garden of Eden, to use that story as our model here, I think this is a historical event, but you can look at it just as a warring force, an account of warring forces too. Eve is told that she is supposed to submit to the Word of God. Adam and Eve both are, but Eve becomes the focus of the narrative, as you know. She is told she's to submit to the Word of God. And she's not to eat of only one tree. God has planted hundreds of trees, right? And God says, okay, if there's one tree, though, don't eat. It will be called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Knowledge calls for standards, justification. This tree will be the test of what justifies good and evil in your eyes. So don't eat of it. Now, I don't believe that tree, historically, had anything magical about it. I don't believe it was any different than any other. It was probably a pear tree, as you know, or apple or banana, whatever it would have been in the Garden of Eden. I don't care. Whatever it was just a natural tree, I believe. What God was saying, though, is, do you submit to my authority above all? Don't eat of this one tree. Arbitrary law just to find out who's number one in your life, Eve. Who is the authority over you? Okay. And so Eve now is tempted by Satan in the form of the serpent. The serpent says, well, you should eat of this tree. She says, no, in the day we eat thereof, we'll surely die. And the serpent says, you won't die. Who told you that? That's preposterous. And now Eve's in a situation where she either submits to the Word of God above all, or she decides that she'll become the master of her fate. She'll decide as her own authority. She'll be the source of value. She'll be the standard of right and wrong. She'll determine what is true and false in her own self-sufficient way. She says, well, God's got a hypothesis and the serpent has a hypothesis, and I guess I'll have to be the judge. Eve, you see, chose the religion of humanism. And we've been suffering the consequences, I believe, ever since. It's only by God's grace that something has happened in history to overcome the religion of humanism. God has sent his own Son into this world to show us the way back. In our blindness and bumping around in the dark out here morally, he's given us the light. He says, now look, if you'll follow, but of course if you follow, it's going to call for something that you don't like. It's going to call for giving up your pride. It's going to call for admitting that you don't know what you're doing, and you aren't the source of right and wrong, and that all of your misery comes from your selfish sin. Now, if you're willing to admit that, there is a way out. There is my Son, the Word of God, who, when he was tempted by Satan, remember, did not say, Well, now, Satan, let's reason about this, okay? Let's come to some neutral standard between us that we can use to judge your hypothesis over against my Heavenly Father's. Jesus said, no, it stands written, Satan. It stands written, Satan. The Word of God says, and that settles it, Satan. Now, does that mean that people who follow Jesus Christ have closed minds? Well, closed-mindedness turns out to be kind of a psychological trait that just about anybody can demonstrate. Often it has to do with intellectual laziness more than perverseness of spirit, I think. But closed-mindedness is not somehow inherent in the Christian outlook on life. In fact, you will find that closed-mindedness is far more congenial to the humanist spirit, because the humanist is always saying, nobody knows for sure, but we know the Christians can't be right. I mean, anything is open except that option. Okay? And so you go on many campuses these days, you talk about in our courts these days, you look around in our culture and you'll find out that it doesn't make any difference. You can promote homosexual perversion, you can promote communism, you can promote violent revolution, you can promote any number of things, but you can't promote traditional religion. You can't promote Christianity. To do that, you see, is a violation of freedom, free speech and the press and all the rest. All in the name of a humanist spirit that says no man will be the standard of everything. We have an open mind toward everything except what God has to say. It's really amazing. So anyway, humanism is a religion, and it's the religion of the Garden of Eden. Here we go with Roman numerals. I should have written this down. This is 1930. See how quickly I computed that. Here I have a little book. In fact, this is a Xerox of the book itself. A little book, and the title page is Humanism, a New Religion, which was published in 1930. And then an article from the Humanist, 1962, it's number one for the year 1962, by Sir Julian Huxley, entitled The Coming New Religion of Humanism. And I only bring those articles along to show you, even visually, that I'm not making this up. The humanists recognize that they are promoting a religion. Okay, now, in your education, what are you getting? Are you getting Christian standards as the foundation of your learning, or do you have humanism at the foundation of everything that's being presented to you? Don't answer that question thinking, oh, here's the way I can find out. I'll ask my teacher, do you follow the religion of humanism? Because not everybody who's a humanist, first of all, would use the word humanism to identify that. After all, humanist means what? Humanities, humanitarian, humane, Renaissance humanism. It can mean any number of things. And those who have the spirit of autonomy in humanism may not particularly like that term. But it's the reality, it's the fact, it's the movement of thought that counts, not the label that is chosen. Moreover, many humanists would probably still be a bit offended by calling this a religion, because for them religion means supernatural. But in the sense we've talked about it this afternoon, religion doesn't have to be supernatural. You can have a naturalistic religion too. Moreover, not everybody who is a humanist self-consciously sets out to develop a philosophy or a religion of life at all. The humanist spirit can be accepted by default, can be followed by default. It can be caught without reflecting on it, just like a person catches measles. You know, people who get measles don't sit down and say, I think measles would be the way to go. No, sometimes it just gets caught. It's in the air. And so is the humanist spirit. It's in the air these days. It is, if you will, the zeitgeist. It's the spirit of our age. The spirit of our age says that what counts is human interest. Man will be the source of value. He will determine his own destiny. He will create a utopia in his own strength. And right and wrong will be determined just as truth and falsity will be decided based on human standards, human research, human authority. See, now that spirit is in the air. And a lot of people think, you know, to be an educated person, you have to be a humanist. You have to believe we have to get out there and find out for ourselves what's right. And we can't just accept on authority, you know, what's right or wrong. But if that's what humanism is, there aren't any humanists, because there isn't anybody around who does all of his research for himself, who draws all of the inferences for himself, who comes to all of the conclusions on his own. everybody accepts the word of somebody else. If they didn't, by the way, we'd be recreating the wheel in every student, in every class, in every university of the land, every day. Because you never can assume what has gone before you. Nobody is a humanist in that sense. And so don't think that humanism is somehow the only foundation for education. I want to propose to you as I close today that, as a matter of fact, humanism is inimical to education. Humanism, I've already made passing allusion to the fact, is closed-minded. It tends to not want to look at all of the options. But more importantly, humanism says that man must be the source of value. But if man is the source of value, then we can ask a couple of very important questions. One, what is the source of absoluteness and logic? One of the most important things, you know, for the advance of human knowledge is not to contradict yourself. If I had a blackboard, which I don't have today, I could show you that from a contradiction you can prove anything in just four steps of reasoning. Okay, you grant me a contradiction and then just give me whatever conclusion you want. I'll show you how the conclusion follows from any contradiction. Okay, so we've got to avoid contradictions. I mean, that's just elementary. Anybody who doesn't realize that cannot really become educated. We have to avoid contradictions. But now let's ask why. Why should the law of non-contradiction be absolute? After all, if the only thing that exists are those things which are the product of evolution, then the way I think is a product of evolution too. What's going on in my mind right now is just some kind of biochemical response. I mean, those electrodes are just, you know, just firing the way they do because that's the way they've been programmed to fire. It's just habit. The fact that it's habit doesn't make it absolute. It just makes it habitual. I mean, there are some people who reach for a needle and jab it in their arm by habit. That hardly makes a creative or a constructive thing to do. So logic has got to have a foundation if education is going to proceed, and yet the humanist can't appeal to any supernatural verification for the laws of logic, as I would as a Christian. And consequently, everything he does has to be tentative, has to say, well, provided the laws of logic hold tomorrow, provided our habit of thinking that we have today is what our minds do tomorrow, or how about moral absolutes? You know, in the last year or so, if you'll look at the news magazines like Time and Newsweek, you will see there have been a number of revelations of people cheating in academic research in order to get grants to advance themselves, to get positions, appointments in their department, and so forth. They've got to get ahead when it comes to research. They have to have these quote-unquote breakthroughs. Well, sometimes a scientific breakthrough can be broken through by fudging on the evidence. Why not? If I'm a humanist, why not? What's important is human welfare. I'm the source of value. And as long as it's in some area that's utterly irrelevant, a good deal of what is done in universities is utterly irrelevant anyway, why don't I just press some utterly irrelevant but falsified conclusion if it gets me ahead? Now, you see, everybody in the academic world shuns that. Everybody says, oh, that's not, they don't shun it. What I mean is when it's caught, they condemn it. They say, this is terrible. It's just like the university instructor in ethics who teaches renal relativism and then screams bloody murder when his motorcycle has been ripped off during class. I mean, they all believe in moral absolutes, and education requires moral absolutes. And yet, if I were a humanist, I'd say, why should I follow moral absolutes? The only absolute I have is what gets me ahead. So, Proverbs tells us that the beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord. And I realize that humbles us. That says we have to bow our heart and bow our minds and say, I didn't make myself, and I'm not the product of just natural forces, and my problems are due to my selfishness and sin, and if I am going to have any light, I must recognize the revelation of God. That's very humbling, but of course it's very constructive too, because it brings me salvation, it brings me human dignity, it brings me the absolutes of truth and logic, and it gives me moral absolutes on top of it. And so, far from being the necessary foundation of education, humanism, I maintain, is inimical to education, and only Christianity can support it. Let me conclude. There are two religions, more than that really, but two religions that are really warring in our culture these days. Humanism as a natural religion, and Christianity as a supernatural word from God, centering on Jesus Christ. They are not friends, even though there has in the past been Christian humanist, because the spirit of humanism is the spirit of Eve and Adam in the garden that says, we'll be a law to ourselves, the spirit of autonomy. And that spirit of autonomy is not only at war with God, it's at war with man. Humanism, if you really trace out its implications, if you look at the results in culture, what it would mean if we were principled and consistent with respect to education, what it means about ethics and our own feeling of human dignity and why we respect one another, humanism turns out to be anti-humanistic. Christianity alone deserves the title humanism because Christianity alone can preserve all that's valuable about human nature. But to do it, it calls for redemption. Right. I wonder, I had meant to stop earlier and give you more time for questions. I realize some of you may have to leave, and if so, please go ahead and do so. But while we wait here, if anybody would like to ask any questions, I'll be glad to entertain them.
What?
Yes, Doug? Okay.
I just wanted to say, we were having a lecture just before I came here, and it was on the Age of the Enlightenment, and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, and it was so different having a secular viewpoint and a Christian viewpoint. And we were getting to the extremes, and it can get into, and that humanism is more towards materialism, because anything that's good is useful, and you can see it and feel the effects of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So. And I asked him, well, how about, you know, murders on stage because it attracts people? And he was saying, well, if that's what is useful, and if then it's accepted. And he said, and I said, and you get in extremes. And he said, that's exactly what happened. But he takes it from a secular viewpoint, too.
Yeah.
And so it expands and all the other things that humans have said.
Yeah, it's possible. It's kind of like lightning bolts of irrationality. You'll have people who will affirm a principle and then you follow it out to an extreme, and they'll take one lightning bolt, you know, and they'll take another jolt here and there. But the question is, will they let the whole picture, you know, be enlightened or darkened by their philosophy and their principle? Would he really want a worldview in which all the implications of humanism or secularism came out? Here's one of the implications. I mean, there are things that we take for granted. I parked my car today. I walked across campus. When I walked across campus, I did not expect anybody to come up and attack me, to grab my briefcase, and I'm assuming nobody has stolen my car. We'll find out about that. Okay. There are people in this world who get their sexual thrills from rape, you know, from child molestation. Now, see, if I were a humanist, what I'd have to say is, the reason why we don't do this is because I have freedom only to the extent that I don't violate the freedom of others. And that sounds very good. That's a great answer, right? No, it's not a great answer. Why should I respect the freedom of others? You see, the humanist always expects me to act like a Christian when I debate his philosophy, to grant him so much space, and then he just varies on a few of the, you know, particulars. But I want to say, no, forget this. You know what human nature is? Human nature is slime oozing out of the slime. That's what we are. We are only at the head of the pack in evolution. And as far as I'm concerned, we have no more right than the trees or the sky or the birds or, you know, elephants, for that matter, to, you know, claim the earth as our own. And consequently, we've got to stop polluting the atmosphere. We've got to stop using modern conveniences. We've got to stop pretending the laws of logic are absolute or that human dignity should be respected. We're giving up everything that's precious to human nature when we become humanist. But what you have, though, in this instructor, and don't bother with his name, in this instructor, what you have is a person living with a Christian worldview and then trying to paint portions of it humanistic. And so, basically, he slaps the face of God, but only because he's first sitting on the lap of God. It's like the child on the airplane, you know, who sitting on mama's lap can slap her face and play that game. But if mama lets the child go, that's it. And God, you see, maintains rebellious sinners like us, calling us back to himself. And some reach up and they slap his face. But if it weren't for his support, if it weren't for the Christian worldview, this man wouldn't be able to say half the things he says. So, yes?
Will you give this lecture again for a semester set?
Will I? That's really, I'm at your disposal. If you'd like me to, I'd be happy to, yes. You know Doug here? I don't know any of you in the room, and I don't know how many of you know Doug. Doug's a member of our church. I'm a pastor in Placentia here at the Covenant Community Church. And so if you talk to him, I'll be happy to come back and give it again. Bring your friends and relatives with you.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.